Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We are going to have a very special program today, a worldwide review of what is happening with one of the most thoughtful, most knowledgeable, most articulate human beings I have ever encountered. And don't take my word for it. If you haven't already read one of his, well, I'm not even sure how many there are now, but he'll tell us, I'm reckoning it's probably 20 at this point, masterful books, both fiction and nonfiction. You need to check out Mark Hilprin's body of work, but you're going to get an introduction to it with this conversation with Mark for a full hour, a very special edition of Securing America, and I couldn't be more pleased to have him back. He's a personal and very dear friend, as well as an extraordinary mentor on all things that matter, and we're going to be talking with him about many of them in the course of this program. Mark Hilprin, welcome back to Securing America. God bless you, sir. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. It's very nice of you to have me on.
Thank you. Let me start by just saying, to set the stage for what I really do think is going to be a tour d'horizon, as the French would say, looking at various challenges that this country is facing, foreign and domestic, I want to put to you a proposition. I've come up with the shorthand way of describing it as World War Xi. And I know I'm not pronouncing it as the Chinese do, but I'm pronouncing it the way most Americans would be able to recognize. Xi Jinping, of course, is the communist dictator of China, the emperor, if you will. And my personal belief, Mark, is that he is directly responsible for just about all of the bad things that are taking place worldwide, and even if not directly, indirectly so. And certainly the principal beneficiary, his country, yes, but also him and his party, of much of what he is doing. I call it strategic arson around the world. Your thoughts, sir?
Well, I see it somewhat differently, but what I see is a descent to what we had in the 30s. But in this case, we have two major powers, Russia and China, China being the major power, then Russia. And each of those powers has a mini-me. In China's case, it's North Korea. And in Russia's case, it's Iran. This is growing. And they use the mini-me's to do some of the work that they don't do directly. Mm-hmm. But these major powers, all four of them are nuclear armed, although Iran is not quite yet, but it's certainly on its way, courtesy of Obama and Biden. These four powers, two big ones and two little ones, have enough juice in them, and they're backed up by their nuclear weapons and their tremendous armies and their strategic position to vault us back to a situation in the 30s where we had Japan and Germany as threats. And generally, people don't recognize this because we feel secure, illegitimately so, wrongly so, because we're not. It will come upon us courtesy of these countries. Now China is very powerful economically. Russia is not, mm-hmm. but Russia is more powerful at the moment in terms of nuclear weapons than China. And what mm-hmm. it comes down to is that Russia, particularly if it wins in Ukraine, will be able to dominate Europe, take it out of the game, and China will be able to dominate Asia, Japan, certainly Taiwan, which it will try to conquer, Australasia, and the productive engine of Asia. Now, these two countries, if Europe is out of the game and our allies in Asia, like North Korea, Japan, Australia, et cetera, are out of the game, then we haven't got much left, particularly given that we have paid no attention to Africa and South America, where China, Russia, and Iran are at the moment dominating, not the United States.
Yes. Let me just say, I think this is mostly a quibble about sort of the ranking of some of these problems. My personal assessment is Xi is the dominant factor in all of those nations.
I agree.
Russia is now more or less a vassal state, still powerful, yes, and still anxious to expand its position in Europe for sure. But basically, it was not an accident that Putin went to Beijing to get Xi's blessing for an invasion of Ukraine.
Any
more than the Iranians and the Palestinian Authority, I think, got a similar blessing in Beijing, and others have done so as well. So, Mark, I guess what I would just simply say is that what we're looking at, we agree, is an environment that is at least as fraught as were the 1930s. And
more
we
so.
Agree that most Americans don't really understand that, let alone that we've actually begun the war that I think Xi finds is going to be beneficial to him and his nation, especially at a time when he is having some very profound difficulties at home.
So it's more so, Frank, because now, unlike the 30s, there are nuclear weapons. And,
sure.
And now China is, because of its population and productive capacity and geographical position, is much more powerful than Japan was.
Right.
And by the way, about Russia being a vassal of China, I wrote years ago a piece which was called Putin's Mistake, which is that he's allowed himself to be taken into the embrace of Xi, that's the end of Russia, because
from which there is no extricating. Yeah. Hotel California kind of thing. And Mark, I guess that's really the crux of the matter, is that if we are looking at a far more powerful adversary in Xi's China than was true even with Hitler and the Japanese, you know, joined up, in part for the very reason that you've just mentioned, that they have made these arrangements, yes, with the Russians, yes, with the Iranians, yes, with the North Koreans and Pakistanis and any number, but also this Belt and Road Initiative, a sort of colonial build out, very much to your point about the influence that they now exercise and will even more in the days to come, I think, in South America and in Africa.
In fact,
a world war with most of the deck stacked against us, it seems.
What you could do is you could add to my little two and two, you can add that China is also replicating the British Empire. Because and of course in World War II there was the British Empire, but it was on our side.
Right.
Now it's on their side.
Yes.
Well, I mentioned Africa and South America and the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just Belt and Road, it's investment and beyond the belt and beyond the road in South America and ports all over the world. You know, they have ports it's bigger in a sense than the British Empire.
It is indeed. We're going to talk about ports. We're going to talk about maritime issues, particularly as they bear on this evolving, dangerous environment for our interest. We are, after all, a maritime power, as you know so well, Mark. You served, as I recall, in the Merchant Marine for a time, as well as the Israeli Army. And
I was in the British Merchant Navy, Royal Navy, and I was in the Israeli infantry and Air Force.
Right. We're going to draw upon all of those experiences to talk with you about the subject of your most recent book, a novel entitled The Oceans and the Stars, a sea story, a love story, and an extraordinarily prescient description of the kind of environment we find ourselves in now. Be right back with Mark Halpern and that and more. Stay tuned.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. This Super Tuesday, Joe Biden is relentlessly touting his commitment to democracy. Unfortunately, his administration's actions with respect to our ally Israel is further evidence that when actual votes are inconvenient, Team Biden is perfectly willing to act undemocratically. This week, retired Israeli General Benny Gantz, a rival to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, currently serving in the war cabinet of his unity government, is being given red carpet treatment in official Washington. Ostensibly, the purpose is to advance Biden's campaign to press the Jewish state to make concessions that will save Hamas. Gantz's visit assuredly has another motivation, however. The U.S. government is not only bolstering enemies of Israel, it shamefully seeks to topple her leader because he, like the majority of his people, reject Biden's demands for a strategically disastrous ceasefire and a state from which jihadists can destroy the Jewish one. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We are visiting for this full, extraordinarily important hour with Mark Halperin, an extremely accomplished author, highly commended for his both novels and his works of nonfiction. The former, most recently, including The Oceans and the Stars. He is a man of very considerable expertise and background, an essayist of innumerable articles, as well as tell me now, how many books, Mark?
Oh, I don't know, about maybe 15, 16. I don't even.
All right, let's round it up to 20. Neither of us know for sure, but you should. In any event, Mark Halperin, I want to talk with you about the most recent one, The Oceans and the Stars. This happens to have come out, as I understand it, been published on the 5th. Of October of last year.
Yes.
And something rather remarkable happened 2 days later that sounds an awful lot like what you were anticipating and writing about in your novel.
Yes, the Al-Aqsa flood happened, the attack on Israel from Gaza happened 2 days later. And in this book, I have united my two sides, the military side and the literary side. And I wrote a novel about essentially the United States Navy in the Red Sea, off Somalia, in the Indian Ocean, fighting Iranian proxies and Iran, in which there were about 200 hostages taken. Mm. And it came out 2 days before this essentially happened. And yet the book has been ignored by the usual suspects. Normally, the New York Times, the Washington Post, NPR, and other bodies like that pay a lot of attention to me in a literary sense. Mm-hmm. This time, they refused. In fact, a very, very eminent NPR person who's always interviewed me wanted to do the interview, and NPR management said, no, you can't. And that happened.
Wow.
Across the board, it's a cancellation is what it is.
It is cancellation.
Yes.
And did anybody explain why they thought you were to be canceled for this book?
They don't ever say why. They don't say why. They say, you know, sorry, we don't have the scheduling. That's how they do it.
All right. So let's just explain why you think you were canceled, because your book laid out a scenario that's uncannily similar to what's happened. I guess one, if we're going to quibble, you were writing about sort of the second phase of the invasion of Israel, but it still was part of the same kind of assault on the West, not just Israel, right?
In other words, it's sort of like the Reagan-esque, we win, they lose, but it's fraught. You see, it's extremely fraught. It's a very difficult situation. And it's a maritime novel too, about a Navy captain, and a lot of other things, because novels should be about a broad spectrum of things. But it's patriotic, and in it, America is not vilified, quite the opposite. And it's also a literary book that could have a wider audience perhaps than a thriller, and yet it has all the elements of that, because I do have experience in all these areas. And
yes.
I, And I brought it to, and also including the politics in Washington, because, for instance, I depict what goes on in the White House, and I've been there.
So you have indeed. And Mark, the thing that I guess is so extraordinary about your body of work, and this book most especially, I believe, is that you are able to communicate with exceptional skill, concepts, as well as, you know, accounts of events or narratives, if you will, but concepts like, you know, well, why the United States is worthy of our patriotic commitment, and why the people that we are fighting, or that the Israelis, for that matter, are fighting, I would argue, on our behalf, are evil. Not just, you know, our enemies, yes, but evil, and called out for being such. Iran just being one of the prime examples of this at the moment.
I'll tell you something. Let me tell you something. When I submitted the book to the publisher, the editor of the book said, in the book, there's an episode where the terrorists actually behead a baby and behead the mother and shoot the father, you know, all this dreadful stuff. And they said, well, this is not something that we can really show because it's too much, et cetera. And I said, but this is what happens. This is what happens. And then 2 days after it was published, it happened exactly. I mean, just the same sort of horrible thing.
Yes. Yes.
But
talk if you would, just on this thought, though, Mark, about the extent to which we are, in fact, in a spiritual war here.
Very, very much so. And Americans don't want to admit the existence of evil, and that we have a part in fighting it. But we do. It's a test. It's a great, great test. And we're failing it, frankly, not to make a pun on your name. But for instance, what happened in Israel is surrounded by Iranian proxies. And we have Hezbollah in the north, and also in the northeast in Syria, the Houthis in Yemen, the Hamas. And, you know, people don't know, Iran has twice the military budget of Israel and 12 times the Jewish population of Israel. It's a very powerful entity. We've been subsidizing it.
Yes.
Of scores of billions in allowing it to harvest its oil revenues, and also giving it plane. We tried to give it $6 billion in cash for a couple of hostages.
And we did give it $10 billion after it attacked Israel through these proxies.
And it attacks us day by day through its
including murdering some American servicemen and trying to murder a whole bunch more.
And we continue to subsidize it.
And as you say, that's bad enough. And it's not just bad enough, it's horrible. But we have, in effect, for the Obama, I would argue, three terms, actively enabled the acquisition of the most dangerous weapons in the world by this regime. And you I think reflect the official line that they don't have those weapons just yet, but I don't know how we would know, because they've been days away from having them at any time for months now. And I think you would agree that we certainly lack the intelligence insights to be able to say for sure whether the sufficient amount of highly enriched uranium has been emplaced in some device or another, and whether that device has in turn been placed on some delivery system or another. Do we have that capability?
I think that as soon as they get, if this is in the absence of an Israeli and or American strike, which unfortunately I don't see and should have been a long time ago, should have been George W. Bush's gift to the country when he left office. Yeah. But in the absence of that, Iran will wait until it has a sufficient number of nuclear weapons, and then it will announce it with a test. Mm-hmm. That's how we'll know that it has what it needs. Yeah. Because, as you
the question
know,
is whether the test will be over some city in Israel or not, and that's the question to which I want to return, Mark.
No,
but
no, no, to, no, wait, to, wait, wait, to wait, 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 no, you don't
go
test.
Ahead.
You don't test it that way because Israel has 200 nukes. And if they tested it and it was only partially successful, then it would be totally destroyed. They will test it on its own ground and make a whole bunch of them. Two or three is not enough. It has to have a lot. But they will announce it. Don't worry about that. They're close.
Yeah. But again, your point is, and I don't disagree necessarily, that they will announce it or test it or do whatever they're going to do to reveal it when they have more than a handful. And the question is, do they already have a handful? And that's a topic, again, to which I hope we can return momentarily. We're going to visit with Mark Helprin, a veteran of Israel's armed forces, about, among other things, the danger Israel is in at the precipice, as he put it recently, and what matters to us as to whether it survives or not. Stay tuned for that and more right after this.
Night after night in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. The author of some 16 books, by his count, I think it's 20, but whatever it is a prodigious body of work. Mark Helprin is the author, and we can't even begin to estimate how many columns and articles and essays he's written in publications like, the New York Times and the Claremont Review of Books and many, many others. He has just shared with us that he has been canceled for having written a patriotic novel, incredibly prescient, about what befell Israel 2 days after it was published. The book is The Oceans and the Stars, and it is a love story. It is a marvelous portrayal of the kind of challenge that Israel is currently facing, and are we, in the Red Sea and elsewhere. But it most importantly, I think, is showcasing the challenge that we face worldwide at this moment, in what I've described as World War Z. Mark, again, you served in Israel's armed forces. You know well the skill, the courage, the enterprise of its military. It is at the moment being tested as arguably never before, because it faces, as you say, an encircling threat, not just most immediately, obviously, in the Gaza Strip, but characterize, if you would, the extent to which the danger to Israel's very survival is now what's on the line. And then we'll talk a little bit about what the Biden administration is doing that is exacerbating that danger.
Yeah, you know, in between 2021 and 2022, Israel actually reduced its military budget. And it did this in the face of oncoming Iranian nuclear weapons and its encirclement by all these proxies. And Israel is one of the two major countries in the world that is slated for destruction publicly, constantly, by its enemies. We don't have other countries that people say, okay, there should be no Germany, or there should be no Canada, whatever. It happens with Israel on a daily basis. In fact, it happens with us. Iran always says death to America and death to
Israel. I was going to say, the other one is us, as it happens, right?
The great
From Satan. Some of the same people.
Yeah, we're the great Satan, they're the little Satan. Right. But in the article that you mentioned, Israel at the precipice once again, what I said, and this was published shortly after October 7th, what I said
in
was—
In the Claremont Review of Books.
In the Claremont Review of Books. It's a long article. I said Israel will be making a mistake if it doesn't hit Iran and Hezbollah first, because Iran is the major existential threat. Gaza is not an existential threat. Iran is. Gaza is not an existential threat. Hezbollah is, because of its 100,000 missiles that can reach many of them anywhere in Israel. And Israel is a tiny country the size of New Jersey, packed with refineries and factories and military bases and ports that can be struck with these missiles, not to mention the civilian population.
Yes.
As the Iranians say, Israel is a one-bomb country, one nuclear weapon over Israel, and that's the end of it. So what I recommended in that article was that Israel do a fait accompli and quickly hit Iran, destroy the nuclear weapons as much as it can, Iran's nuclear weapons and missilery. It's the biggest missile power in the Middle East and one of the biggest in the world. One would hope in conjunction with the United States, but possibly alone. I think Israel can do it, although I'm not absolutely certain, but my experience and what I know tells me that yes, they can. It would be a great risk to them, and possibly risking everything, their destruction. That's the real challenge.
And that's just with the purpose being degrading the capabilities of the Iranians, and presumably you're talking about Hezbollah at the same time, right?
I think that they could set Iran back 20 years in terms of its nuclear development. And also, don't forget, if you attack Iranian nuclear, the Iranian nuclear infrastructure, you have a second tier to fall back on, which is, if of course they would protest, they would be very upset. But then it's very easy to wipe out their economic capacity because it's all oil. You could hit and destroy their economy very, very easily by knocking out all the oil facilities, the transit facilities, the pipelines, they're vulnerable in that sense. So if we, the United States or Israel, were to attack the Iranian nuclear infrastructure, the second strike, in effect, what we have a second strike capability, which is, okay, if you then react in a way that is very dangerous to us, we'll do a second strike and completely ruin your economy. You can't eat your oil, and you won't even be able to pull it from the ground because there won't be electricity. So Israel and the United States have that option. I recommended that Israel take that option because Iran is the threat, and that then it also turned to Hezbollah, because that is a major threat, whereas Gaza is not. And right. Then, if that were successful, it would be quick. It would be a fait accompli. And the world opinion wouldn't have the months and months and months that it's had to develop sympathy for the Palestinians, the mm-hmm. civilians in Gaza who are suffering, and turn against Israel.
Yeah. And are you as confident of Israel's ability, especially now, with much of what it had in its arsenal used against Gaza, to degrade decisively Hezbollah and all of those tens of thousands of missiles and rockets?
Yes. Hezbollah, yes. Because, you know, if you look at the past several months in Gaza, the Air Force hasn't been doing very much, and it's the Air Force that would do much in against Hezbollah. Also, the type of infantry fighting in Gaza is different from what would be accomplished again in Lebanon against Hezbollah, because it's more like an old fashioned war, a guerrilla war with very high tech things like robots and tunnel warfare and very intelligence rich, spotting individual guerrillas terrorists who pop out of tunnels and everything like that. With Hezbollah, it's more like a conventional army, where armor, especially the Israeli protective armor, because they have this system called Trophy, which if someone fires an RPG at a tank or an armored personnel carrier, trophy will can defeat it. So they can move with armor into southern Lebanon, unlike before when they were hit terribly, because they have these new systems and they have better intelligence, and the Air Force has pretty much been conserved. So its power is still waiting to be used.
So it's when
bogged down in Gaza, that's the problem. Man.
Yeah. Well, it's bogged down in Gaza. And as you say, the world has adjusted to sympathize with the Palestinians. And I want most especially, Mark, to visit with you about the Biden administration and its policies, because I think, frankly, one of the reasons why Israel didn't actively contemplate or at least pursue the option that you've just described towards Iran and Hezbollah is the United States under Biden from the get-go was adamantly opposed to them doing so. You mentioned that they gave Iran $10 billion in that window, but they also moved two carrier battle groups into position, I think, less to protect Israel than to try to discourage it from operating unilaterally, perhaps even interfering with such an attack if it were to happen. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, it's notable that I don't think they would have done that, but it's notable that Zbigniew, never can pronounce it, Brzezinski, mm-hmm. Carter's national security advisor, advocated that if Israel were to send an aerial armada toward Iran to eliminate its nuclear weapons, that the United States should shoot them down.
Right.
And that type of thought, I certainly wouldn't say that it was not continued into the Obama and the Biden administration. Mm-hmm. We've had in those two administrations, three administrations, almost 12 years of essentially an alliance with Iran. And so yes.
To say nothing of people like Arian Tabatabai, who's been identified as an Iranian agent serving as the chief of staff for the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Low Intensity Conflict. I mean, you can't make this stuff up, Mark, the degree of compromise and wrongheadedness of what's been done here.
Yeah, what I would say is only the United States is powerful enough and crazy enough to be supporting two sides in the same war at the same time.
Well, and that's what I want to visit about. I mean, one of the issues here is, of course, that the United States government does continue, and I think this is important, resupplying Israel's military. But it seems as though it is increasingly choking down on that resupply. And in almost every other respect, it seems to be actively aiding and abetting Israel's enemies, saving Hamas, for example. And in this regard, Mark, just a quick question to you. The administration is including in that kind of agenda toppling the elected government of Israel. And as we speak, the vice president of the United States is supposed to be meeting shortly with one of the members of Israel's war cabinet, who absolutely detests Bibi Netanyahu and is seeking to replace him, Benny Gantz, who came here to Washington without the foreknowledge and permission of the prime minister. We have to take a short break, Mark, but when we get on the other side of this, I want to just ask, am I overstating the degree of hostility that this administration is exhibiting towards Israel? And what are the implications of it for Israel's survival? You're going to want to hear Mark's answer to all of that on the other side of this short break. I hope you'll stay tuned to hear from the author most recently of The Oceans and the Stars, the extraordinary journalist, investigative reporter, strategic analyst, and author, Mark Halperin, right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. This Super Tuesday, Joe Biden is relentlessly touting his commitment to democracy. Unfortunately, his administration's actions with respect to our ally Israel is further evidence that when actual votes are inconvenient, Team Biden is perfectly willing to act undemocratically. This week, retired Israeli General Benny Gantz, a rival to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, currently serving in the war cabinet of his unity government, is being given red carpet treatment in official Washington. Ostensibly, the purpose is to advance Biden's campaign to press the Jewish state to make concessions that will save Hamas. Gantz's visit assuredly has another motivation, however. The U.S. government is not only bolstering enemies of Israel, it shamefully seeks to topple her leader because he, like the majority of his people, reject Biden's demands for a strategically disastrous ceasefire and a state from which jihadists can destroy the Jewish one. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome once again to Mark Halperin, who has generously given us his time to have a, I think an extraordinarily timely conversation about what's going on in World War G, and specifically in the Middle East theater, in which he spent a lot of time, including as an infantryman in the Israel Defense Forces. And Mark, I was asking you about the Biden administration's policies more generally, but specifically what I consider, especially coming from an administration that has made a mantra of its defense of democracy, that it is trying to take down the elected government of Israel, of Benjamin Netanyahu, including this very day, as we speak, seemingly conniving with one of his rivals, albeit a man inside his war cabinet, his unity government. What are we to make of all of this and its implications for Israel?
Well, I think the administration has accomplished a twofer here. On the one hand, they are having Benny Gantz meet with Kamala, which is how it's pronounced properly, Kamala in Hindi.
She does get it wrong herself on occasion, after all. It's confusing.
That's in Hindi, Kamala.
Uh-huh.
By having Gantz meet with Harris, the vice president, it's a twofer because, one, they're emphasizing her supposed confidence, which is a drag on her lack of it, is a drag on Biden's reelection possibilities.
Did you say confidence or competence?
Competence. Incompetence, but... They want her to appear competent by meeting with a foreign leader. Otherwise, it's a drag on Biden's election prospects. Two, that's one. And two, they can exert tremendous pressure on Netanyahu in Israel to do what they want. Because here's the problem for them. The problem for them is that because this is existential for Israel, Israel may not pay attention because they're going to threaten Israel with, if you keep on going in Gaza the way you say and finish off Hamas.
Specifically by going into Rafah.
By going into Rafah and by, as Israel has done, making a half a mile belt along the perimeter to protect the kibbutzim in the southern sector of Israel. If you go against our wishes like this, we'll cut off your supplies. And public opinion in the United States is moving that way. So, that's what we'll do. So you better do what we want. Now, here's the thing.
And maybe throw in a UN Security Council resolution that demands a ceasefire.
Yeah,
to
we have tremendous leverage over Israel. But it's possible that Israel will say, no, and then Netanyahu will say, I'm not going to do this in a kind of a Churchillian way and say, we've got to get this done and we're going to do it. And then we'll see. We'll see in the future. So they want to put as much pressure as they can. And this is one way of doing it.
Right. Putting the pressure on Benjamin Netanyahu by supporting a rival for power, which plays into this idea that they're seemingly trying to engineer elections conflict.
In the Obama administration, they did that openly. They sent people.
But Israel was not directly engaged in this kind of level of hostilities at the time, as I recall.
Right. This is much worse.
Yeah, and again, I think those of us who love Israel, and I'm sure that our audience does, I know you and I do, the prospect that this could do anything other than embolden her enemies to believe that they could have their way with Israel. I mean, it is classic. Matches into a tinderbox that that I fear could go very, very badly. Mark, let me just reserve the rest of our time to broaden the lens a bit here, because you are a man of the world and you are thoughtful about a whole host of issues. One of the other places where the strategic arson, as I said earlier, Xi Jinping, I think, is in evidence is Ukraine. I'd be interested in your thoughts on the prospect that if, as things now stand, Putin feels he will win there, he may not be content with leaving it at that.
Yeah, well, Putin's ace in the hole in Ukraine is his tactical nuclear weapons, and the strange thing is that if the Ukraine, and I say the Ukraine because I'm old enough,
Of an age.
77, to could still call it that, if Ukraine is in if there's a prospect that they'll take back Crimea, then Putin will go nuclear. So it's never going to happen. That they'll never take Crimea, and I'm sure that Zelensky knows this too. They know it. What they want is to get as much of the Donbas as they possibly can, and then hold it there and arm up so that Russia can't attack them more. That's Putin's nuclear doctrine. Russia's famous promiscuously low nuclear threshold is his main ace in the hole, and with Europe too, with NATO. But if it becomes a situation where we don't support Ukraine enough to at least have them hold the line where it is now, then Europe eventually will fall, or if not fall, become so impoverished with arranging its own defense that it will fall out of the picture, and we will not have that kind of adjunct ally to help us in the broader world situation, which is actually, and you're right, it's China is the main enemy there.
Right. Provide for its own defense, of course, is something that it hasn't done a lot of since the end of the Second World War, certainly since the end of the Cold War, most especially, relying on us and NATO to protect it.
But let me
Do you
say
see
something.
that changing?
First of all, it is changing. Even Germany proposes 3.5% of GDP to devote to defense, which is more than what we do. And of course,
Proposes, or do you think that they're actually going to do it?
I think they'll do it. The other countries are slowly coming up. But let me say something about that, and that is this: in an alliance like NATO, or like any kind of informal Pacific alliance that we have, ASEAN or whatever it is, whatever it may be, you have to have a central power. That will allow the other members to adhere to it. So we must be the leading power in NATO. And in a sense, that kind of justifies their behavior in terms of burden sharing
Right.
up to this point,
Up
because
to this point, Mark, we have to ask you to take a short break. We'll be coming back right after this to complete that thought. Mark Halperin is in the house, the author of The Oceans and the Stars, and much more. Stay tuned. Welcome back, and a very special welcome once again to our guest for this full hour, Mark Halperin, an extraordinary storyteller and analyst. I commend you his body of work, including most recently, The book for which he has apparently been canceled. Why? Because it was too prescient, too patriotic, too useful to understanding the kind of environment we're in, the good versus evil, spiritual warfare, among other things that we find ourselves and our allies confronting. And Mark, I had to cut you off. You were talking about American leadership in NATO, but I think more generally, finish that thought if you would.
Yeah, well, the point that I wanted to make is that Americans think we're safe. And this is really at the heart of our problem and the danger. We think we're safe because traditionally we've been so powerful, and also we've been protected by the vastness of the oceans on the east and the west, the Atlantic and the Pacific. Mm-hmm. But you know, here's the thing. Even in the Revolutionary War, when there were wooden ships, when going across the ocean took months and was extremely dangerous, and the cargoes that they carried were so small, even then, we were almost conquered by Britain. I mean, we almost lost the Revolutionary War. And in 1812, the same thing could have happened. Mm-hmm. And in the First World War, I'm sure your readers, your viewers are familiar with the Zimmermann telegram.
Yes.
Germany wanted to enlist Mexico so they could have bases and invade us from Mexico. And in World War II, my father, who was in intelligence, was sent to Mexico, to the coast, to the western coast of Mexico, to observe the Japanese so-called fishing fleet, which was before the war. They were making maps of the coast of Mexico because they wanted to invade. We are not safe, especially in the era of intercontinental ballistic missiles, bombers that are intercontinental, and our open society, which allows penetration on every level, not just cyber, but people coming here and establishing themselves in ways that are truly a great threat to the United States. I mean, in the Biden administration alone, we've let in 10 million unvetted people, including many, many from China, from Iran, from other places. We just let them in, and we don't know what they're about.
And especially given the demographics of that population, which seems to include, if not mostly, certainly a very large percentage of unaccompanied
young men,
fighting age young males. And they've come from places like communist China. Some say they're, you know, special forces, no less, from communist China. But you've got jihadis from Iran and Afghanistan and God only knows where else. And not least, we've actually legally admitted some 70,000 of them from, the Taliban's Afghanistan. This is a formula for disaster, Mark. So as you look, just in conclusion, as you look at this world situation, what must Americans understand about the environment we're in now and what it is going to take for us to survive, to say nothing of Israel, the various enemies that we face?
Well, what it will take is a much, much greater investment in our military, the Navy in particular, because those oceans do protect us to some extent, but not without a Navy. And our Navy is really going to seed, whereas China's is building up as fast as we're going down. And it will also take
faster.
The elites of the country. Let me just say this, if I can quickly get this in. I've been reading an essay by Walter Russell Mead about Thucydides and Polybius, the Peloponnesian Wars. And in the Peloponnesian Wars, the elite of Athens were willing to lose the war as long as their position was assured. And we find ourselves in a similar situation. The elites in America feel that they're citizens of the world. They are willing to redo America and possibly lose a war, to be dominated from outside, as long as their positions are assured. Yeah. That's wrong, and we should end that.
Let me plug another book, Mark. You are a wonderful member of our committee on the present danger of China. In fact, one of the founding members. And this book, The Indictment, Prosecuting Communist China and Friends for Crimes Against America, China and the World, is born of the many webinars I think you've contributed to, one or more of them that we've conducted over the years about precisely this problem, the unrestricted warfare China's waging against us and the help that they've been getting from America's elites. And I just, as a student of history, nonpareil, as they say, I would ask you, what are the prospects based on historical practice of the tyrants and totalitarians and most especially communists, that elites who sell out their country will actually prosper in a post America world?
Well, you know, there's the famous saying that Churchill said, the people who feed the tiger hoping that the tiger will eat them last, they continue feeding it, and then eventually the tiger eats them. Eventually the tiger will eat those elites, although there's always space for what in the Holocaust were called capos, the people who assisted the concentration camp runners to do their
sure.
job.
But my understanding of how this generally works is the elites are not going to be the capos. Those are just going to be, you know, the little people. The capos are going to be taken, rather the elites are going to be taken out, put against the wall and shot at the very beginning of, you know, the post-liberation period, as they would call it in China. I really am concerned that if we don't clean up this problem with elites that are playing for the other side, starting with, I have to say, regrettably, the commander-in-chief of the United States, who one of our colleagues on the committee, Sam Faddis, has famously described, based on his experience recruiting and running agents for the Central Intelligence Agency, Biden is, quote, a controlled asset of the Chinese Communist Party, unquote. And this is a dangerous situation on top of all the other things we've talked about. Very quickly, we've got 20 seconds.
Well, I can't endorse that because I don't know that. And I think that may be not so. I probably is not so. I think he's befuddled enough to do that kind of work without having been a controlled asset. Although obviously he's in bed with them in terms of his son getting literally $500 million.
Mark, we have to leave it at that. We're out of time. We'll leave that for a further day's conversation. Thank you for your time today. Mark Halperin, the author of most recently of The Oceans and the Seas. We'll be back next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.